Look, what I'm about to tell you gonna sound crazy. You ready?
All right. Try me.
I believe they've been abducting black people, brainwashing them, and making them slaves, or sex slaves, not just regular slaves, but sex slaves and shit. See, I don't know if it's the hypnosis that's making them slaves or whatnot, but all I know is they already got two brothers we know, and it could be a whole bunch of brothers they got already.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus movie review of Get Out.
You'll be able to see and hear, but your existence will be as a passenger, an audience.
Hosted by Arnie.
You were one of my favorites.
Stuart.
I am an admirer of your work.
And Jacob.
We're thrilled to have you up here for the get-together.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
You could give a shit, right? Okay. Just let me just tell you what it is.
Listener discretion is advised.
It begins. You ready for this?
Record. Speaker. Unmute.
Today we're discussing Get Out! Starring Daniel Kaluuya, Allison Williams, Bradley Whitford, Caleb Landry Jones, Stephen Root, Lakeith Stanfield, and Catherine Keener, directed by Jordan Peele. This is the Now Playing co-host who, if I could, I would have voted for Obama for a third term, Arnie. I mean, did you see those options? And this is Stuart.
This is Jacob with NP motherfucking P. I podcast shit. That's what I do.
And this shit's been podcasted. And this shit's being podcasted to you guys, our patrons. Welcome back once again. Thank you so much for your patronage of our show. I don't know that I can express how quickly the three of us would have to get out of podcasting if it wasn't for people like you supporting this show. So thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for supporting us, because I don't know if we get to review this movie otherwise. And after I saw it, I really wanted to talk about it.
I think everyone does. I definitely feel like it starts a conversation, and it was huge. Do you guys realize this is one of the top five biggest horror movies of all time?
Yeah, it broke a record previously held by Blair Witch.
Yeah, well, as an original concept, but I mean anything. I mean, the only thing ahead of it is Jaws, Exorcist, World War Z, if you count that.
What? How'd that get up there?
Yeah, but this is up there in the upper echelon. I don't think that Universal and Blumhouse were expecting it to be this big, but it came at an interesting time in American history, and it came bringing a whole lot of goods, including the talent of Jordan Peele, who is a comedian I know mostly from his TV show.
Yeah, so I have to just ask, why are we reviewing this now? If it made that much money, when's Get Out 2 and 3 and 7 coming out? Why didn't we wait for the sequel?
2019, Jordan said his next film's coming out. It's not a sequel, though.
I imagine we might get a follow-up, but I'm not sure it will be a direct sequel to what we're seeing. And more to the point, you guys are patrons, and I know people have asked us to do this, and so this is the way that we could do this.
And Stuart, I agree. I was a big fan of Key and Peele. I really enjoyed that show on Comedy Central. I disagree with Dave Chappelle that they're ripping off his show. They did their own thing, and I really enjoyed it. And, you know, when they got together to do Keanu, not a great comedy, but it was entertaining. I liked seeing them together in that.
And I don't really know these guys very much. I've seen a little bit of their TV show from time to time. I've seen them mostly on other shows where they've appeared together and done some stuff in sitcoms, and I think they did some Inside Amy Schumer stuff. I saw. I have not seen Keanu, but I'm very aware of who they were. And so that's kind of why I wasn't too interested in Get Out. You take this sketch comedian, he's making a horror movie. I'm a bit of a horror snob. I was scared this was going to be like Scary Movie or something, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I like horror movies when they're charged with political ideas, when they have something to say about the time that they're made, the social ills, they're tapping into things that matter, horrifying real life events taken on a surreal, supernatural level. Don't tell me that the women's movement, abortion, and all that late 60s, early 70s talk about women's bodies didn't inform Rosemary's Baby, It's Alive, The Omen, The Exorcist. I think that movies come out at the right time. And yeah, this happens to be a movie about race at a time when that is a huge subject of discussion.
And I remember the trailer for this coming out, and that really got people talking just from that trailer, because you watch that trailer and you know it's about race. And yeah, that's when BLM and all the stuff with cops were going on. It touched upon, I guess, just the right time. And yeah, with horror, I'm the one that's the least horror fan, but I've really seen this resurgence. I don't know to call it art horror or what, but The Witch or It Follows, Get Out, I would throw in there. Even The Neon Demon, which I don't know if I like that movie, but I can't stop thinking about it, like where they've really taken these horror concepts and just gone very high level, very artistic with them and trying to touch upon what's going on now.
Yeah, I saw the trailer for this. It still didn't get me interested. What made me want to see this movie was the buzz around it, everything I read about it. But I found that I was reading a lot more about race relations than horror. And so I didn't know, is this a movie that's going to exist because it's discussing race? Is that why it's popular? I didn't realize the box office till Stuart told me just now. Or is it actually a good horror movie? But despite actually making plans a couple of times to see this, people kept backing out. And then we decided we were going to do it as a patron. So I intentionally didn't see this when it was released on home video, saving it so that I could be a complete newbie for this review.
Yeah, I think that when you're looking specifically at African Americans making horror films, we've touched on that before. Night of the Living Dead, I think, stumbled upon it accidentally by casting their lead as a black man. It ended up taking on a whole lot of metaphorical ideas that maybe weren't even intended by Romero, but it informed that movie. But most of the time, I hate to say it, but it really is played like camp. I mean, dare I bring up the two Leprechaun films where he went to the hood, or Children of the Corn 3, Urban Harvest. I don't even think Blade and Vamp count because they're black actors. Incidentally, I don't think that it's about being black in a horror situation in those movies. So, sadly, the subject is tended to be treated as camp. It's B-movie stuff, and you get a Tales from the Hood every now and then, a Death by Temptation. The ideas are serious, but the presentation is not. And that's what I feared Get Out would be. I was happily surprised when I went to the movie theater. I went with two women, one that was very much about promoting Afrocentric ideas, and one that didn't like horror movies but felt, as a black woman, she should see the film.
And I'm with you somewhat, Arnie. When this came out, I heard great things, and I did wonder, this conversation, is it such a hit because it's falling on the right time, even though it might be campy and that, or is it legitimately just a good movie? This thing was out in theaters for a while because it ended up being such a big hit. I think I saw it like a month after it came out, and usually movies are gone by then, but yeah, I did go see this one in theaters.
And to your point, Stuart, there's that trope that we've discussed so many times. When you even have black people in horror films, they're the ones who die first. Something Scream 2 pointed out so clearly, and I think Scream 2 really did open my eyes to that fact. But I don't know of a lot of black horror movie makers. You know, you did mention Tales from the Hood, which is actually good horror. You're right. The presentation isn't the most serious, but I was surprised how much I liked that one. But by and large, it does seem like if I'm thinking about African-American made horror films, I am sadly thinking of the Scary Movie franchise from the Wayans.
Yeah, Ganja and Hess is sort of a classic. I'll put air quotes around that. I don't know a lot of people would like it. It's very arty and low budget, but it certainly dealt with a lot of ideas about race and slavery in a vampire scenario. It was recently remade by Spike Lee as, I'm going to try to say it, The Sweet Blood of Jesus. Not a very good adaptation, but had a few memorable scenes. By and large, though, I feel like African-Americans, if they end up directing horror, it's a studio project. They're doing it because this is a way to further their career. It's not necessarily a way of talking about what they're most passionate about. And so that's why this is so interesting. Jordan Peele, every now and then, would slip into his show little segues that were weird and horrific. I remember one episode having a whole lot to do with The Shining, and it wasn't laugh out loud funny. It was kind of creepy.
His favorite horror movie, that's why we'll get a Shining reference in this one.
Yeah, I feel like Kubrick looms large here, but he's a student of it. I can tell, watching this movie, without a doubt, this man has paid attention to Kubrick, he's paid attention to Roman Polanski, and listened to the commentary on the Blu-ray. It's a litany of him celebrating what has been done in the past. He loves this genre, and he wanted to use this genre to talk about race in America today. Well, take that back. he wrote this in the Obama era. He wrote this for what he calls a different era in race relations, and I definitely feel like it takes on certain concerns that may or may not be relevant now that we're living in the Trump era.
Or I would say anything is more relevant living in the Trump era. The one thing I will say going into this, just to kind of level set, I like horror films, but primarily more slashery type horror films. You mentioned Rosemary's Baby. I don't like Rosemary's Baby by and large. I find it to be inordinately dull and a film that does not work outside of its time period. And the more I see horror films of that ilk, I'm not a fan of them. I don't like the slow, moody. Goddamn, the worst one I've seen recently is that Lords of Salem that Rob Zombie did. I find that to be indicative of all of that type of horror.
Yeah, I'll say the first two-thirds of this is more of a thriller, and then it kind of goes horror at the end. But I do like that kind of horror where it's just that atmosphere is uncomfortable, and there's lots of tension, and this is full of that.
I do think the film benefited by not being gore-heavy. It kind of goes crazy right at the end, but by and large, this is a movie you can watch with just about anyone. I ended up rewatching it with my mother, who doesn't like horror movies at all. And like I said, the people that I went to the movie theater with, one of them did not like horror movies. She liked comedy. And the fact that Peele comes from that world as well, I think that was the draw. And this movie walks that fine line. It really is a horror comedy. By and large, I haven't felt like that is a hybrid genre that's worked too well in the movies.
I think it's definitely had its high points. Once again, I'll bring up Scream, and I'll bring up most of the Nightmare on Elm Street films. You need to sometimes cut the tension. I hear so many horror directors that I've read interviews with or listened to commentaries on, you build the suspense and the audience eventually needs a release. The best release you can give them is laughter. So all the best horror movies have comedy. I did definitely find this one very funny and intentionally so, but that didn't make it not spooky. It was spooky in a funny way at times.
I think if you're going into this thinking like Cabin in the Woods, I don't think it's that kind of comedy. There's definitely those moments where it cuts the tension. I think there's one character that all that comedy primarily relies on.
I think it's not campy per se. I mean, it plays with that here and there with cliches of the genre, but by and large, I was surprised at how under my skin it got, that it really is about tension and nerves and Polanski slow build dread. So yeah, I'm curious, Arnie, knowing that you have that bias, how you're going to take all of this. Why don't you give them the plot? We'll get into the movie and see how it all works out.
Daniel Kaluuya plays Chris, a 20-something African-American going home to meet the family of his white girlfriend, Rose Armitage, played by Allison Williams. There he meets Rose's neurosurgeon father, Dean, played by Bradley Whitford, and her hypnotist-slash-psychiatrist mother, Missy, played by Catherine Keener, as well as Rose's confrontational brother, Jeremy, played by Caleb Landry Jones. Chris is made a bit uncomfortable by some of the comments made by Rose's family, and that they have two African-American employees, a maid, Georgina, and a yard man, Walter. And neither one of those employees acts quite right. But things go really strange when Rose invites over all their rich friends, all of whom seem strangely obsessed with Chris's race. What Chris doesn't realize is he's falling slowly into the Armitage's trap. It turns out the Armitage family has perfected a form of brain transplant. They and their aging friends want younger, stronger bodies, and many of them want to be black. So Rose has been luring her black boyfriends back to the house, and each one is auctioned off to the highest bidder. Then neurosurgeon Dean performs the brain transplant, and the high bidder lives life in a new body. And it turns out Walter is actually Dean's father in a new body, and Georgina is Dean's mother. Missy hypnotizes Chris, and they tie him up, preparing to put into his body the brain of blind art gallery proprietor Jim, played by Stephen Root. But Chris escapes his captivity and kills all the Armitages on his escape as credits roll.
And we begin where else? The epitome of tranquility, at least for white America, the suburbs. Nothing bad ever happens here, unless you happen to be Andre Hayworth, who is a jazz musician wandering around the lamppost looking for a girlfriend he's talking to on his cell phone.
Yeah, and this is where we get that Shining reference right away. The suburbs are like a hedge maze.
Yeah, I immediately got that. And you're putting me in the right mood if you're referencing that Kubrick film. I'm like, okay, this is a person who knows his horror. I didn't watch Key and Peele. I didn't know there were Shining references in there. But this was an oblique enough reference to put me in a good mood. And And I wasn't sure which way this would go, quite honestly. I knew things weren't going to go well for this guy out alone in the suburbs at night, but was it going to be horror, or was it going to be the police rolling up? And I knew nothing about this film coming in, but I do know, because I watch the news and I read newspapers, that this could go probably one of two ways in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, you think of the suburbs from a race perspective, it's white flight. This is the white people territory. This is where they went to get out of the urban area. So I'm worried for Andre.
Yeah, and we're definitely worried for him when the white car pulls up. It's playing this really menacing song, Run Rabbit Run.
I looked that up. I'm like, is this from Song of the South? Because it seems like something that would be from there. But no, it's just an old timey song about a, you know, run rabbit run or the farmer's going to shoot you.
One thing I'll say about this movie, I thought about it a lot, more than even usual for now playing. I found myself making linkages after I saw how the movie ended. I didn't go back and rewatch it and get a lot, but just chewing the movie over. And so one thing that I started wondering about is, what exactly happened here at the beginning? Who's this guy? I'm going to preface, I thought this was going to be a haunted house film. I didn't know from the trailers. It's called Get Out. I'm thinking Amityville. Specifically, I'm thinking back. Anyone who's listened for a long time knows I love Eddie Murphy. And Eddie Murphy had that sketch about how a black person would respond in Amityville.
Get out.
We gotta go, honey. And so I really thought that's the kind of movie I was going to watch. So when I see a person get abducted by another human, I don't know what that is. I now realize what was going on here. I think that was the brother?
Yeah, that's Rose's brother.
Okay.
It'll be confirmed at the end.
We'll see that helmet he's wearing.
Yeah, it's a knight's helmet. And I didn't pick this up until I heard the commentary the director made. This is a group that has got roots in his mind all the way back to the Knights of Templar and the Holy Grail. I'll elaborate what I got from him on that as we get into the movie. But this is a secret society that has been at work on co-option and immortality for centuries.
So this guy at the beginning was wearing that helmet. I noticed the shot of the helmet later on. I didn't catch that this guy was wearing a helmet. Mostly the shot doesn't focus on his head. We see him pretty much everything from the neck down, so I didn't catch the helmet.
That's what told me this was really dangerous. Not just that a human was abducting another human, but that, yeah, he had this knight's helmet on.
And again, in a crowded movie theater, big jump scare.
Yeah.
It didn't get me because I knew what was probably coming once I saw the car, but it pulled me in, and I'm like, okay, you got me with the early kill. I'm assuming this guy's dead, and what is this movie going to be then? But this is something that you could easily forget about throughout the movie. And in fact, I didn't recognize that character from the beginning when he came back later on. He's acting totally different, and I didn't spend enough time with him at the beginning to really catch him that much. So it was something that, again, it stuck with me, and later on, I had that aha kind of moment.
The director has said, you know, he's talked to a lot of audiences, it is a common mistake that people do not necessarily connect him to what he will become. And that's why he advocates, and I do too, seeing this movie twice is very helpful.
Yeah, having watched it twice now, there's a lot of stuff I picked up on the second time that I missed the first time. But I do love, we get this abduction scene, and then we get this strange just shot. It seems like it's going the wrong direction. I know film, it has a certain language, and you're supposed to move, what, like right to left? This is going from left to right over this tree line, like we're going somewhere else, and we get this chanting. I'm thinking of like Wicker Man. If you've seen that original one, lots of weird songs going on in this strange village. But this is what, Swahili, I believe, that's actually being chanted.
I don't know what's being chanted, but my favorite thing of this entire movie is the score. Before the movie was even done, I had purchased the score.
Does it have this song on there?
It does indeed. There's a lot of good music in that score. It's really moody. It's really atmospheric, but it also, at times, it almost sounds like music in older movies about African Americans. It's just kind of a weird combination that's going on there. I grooved like hell to this score, and I'm so happy they put it out.
This opening chant is a warning to the character. Jordan Peele says there's a tradition with African American moviegoers where they talk to the screen, and so he wanted to replicate that through this Swahili chant telling, brother, get out, go away, it's not safe.
Yeah, it's a mixture, I think, of English as well.
Yeah, they say brother in English.
What he told the composer was, I want a satanic Negro spiritual. So yes, the tradition going all the way back to the cotton fields of African American singing is what they were referencing, but also has that Damien, Omen, Damien, Omen, that Jerry Goldsmith did so well in The Omen.
You know what? If that's what he told that composer, I looked him up. I guess this is a first-time film composer. He is perfect for this because that's what I got out of it. I didn't even know that was the thing, but I'm like, there's something satanic here, which I was digging it. I like music like that, like O Fortuna and stuff that just has that kind of cataclysmic satanic vibe. But then, yeah, it had a bit of a spiritual, traditional song type of instrumentation going too.
It's chorus, it's fiddles, it's banjos. You definitely are thinking of the South. This was shot in Mobile, Alabama, but I think it's actually supposed to be set in Brooklyn and then, you know, upper New York State.
Yeah, they never say where they are. They're just like, we're coming from the city.
And I think that's good. I mean, I think everywheresville, that's what they want. Yes, we start in an urban environment to establish our main character, Chris Washington.
This is an actor I'm not overly familiar with. Daniel Kaluuya. We talked about him with Kick-Ass 2.
I guess.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
He made impression on me one time and it blew me away. But I don't know if you guys watched the TV show Black Mirror. It's British. It's not about race. Black Mirror refers to a screen, a computer screen or your cell phone screen. It's kind of like a Twilight Zone. So every episode is a different take on technology and the horrors that it could lead to. And he was in a very memorable one about, well, I'll let you discover it. It's kind of take on American Idol called 15 Million Merits.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but good about Black Mirror. I have not watched it. This is an actor we'll be talking about again come February. He will be in Black Panther.
Yeah, and he's great. I just want to say, as someone that has seen so many horror movies, you just never get the kind of acting that we get in this movie. It is phenomenal, top to bottom, starting here with Daniel. He's just great in this movie. He is the center. He will get everyone on their side instantly.
Agreed. I love this actor. There's one scene that we'll talk about where I'm like, damn. He is amazing.
I already know the scene.
He's good throughout. I mean, he's good in being a fun kind of presence on screen. When we're being introduced to him, we're meeting him, we're meeting his girlfriend Rose, and I just like this couple instantly, and their guess who's coming to dinner kind of scenario where he's talking about going and meeting Rose's family. Have you told them that I'm black? Why would I? Does it matter? I'm guessing you both have seen Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. I don't know if a lot of our listeners have. It is an older movie. I thought we might just be going into that kind of scenario. Again, I'm thinking Ghost House here, so I think he's going to visit them in a ghost house.
And because I had seen that trailer, this is a warning sign. Oh, you're bringing the black boyfriend home, you're the white girl, you're saying you never dated a black guy. I know kind of where the scenario is going. I don't know the role everyone is playing, though, so I still get surprised as the movie unfolds.
If you came in really cold and they didn't have that intro scene, if you came 5 minutes late, you might actually think this was a romantic comedy, because they got real chemistry here. And I think if a different actress was playing this, we might conclude very quickly she's in on the evil shenanigans here. But I want Rose to be good. I love them as a couple. It's painful to think that she's leading him into a trap.
Yeah, I'll agree. These two work so well together. And when it's revealed, I'm like, no, wait. How can I explain this away so that Rose isn't evil too?
Once we find hypnosis is involved, I'm like, okay, that's what's going on. She's really good. And when I watched this a second time, my wife was watching it her first time, and she was going through that same thing. Oh, she's hypnotized. She's really good. She's not a bad guy. I mean, Jordan Peele, as a first-time director for a film, that's got to be different than sketch comedy. He gets great performances out of everyone in this film.
Yeah, and it should be say Allison Williams. This is her first movie, but she did spend 6 seasons on HBO's Girls. Didn't really watch that show, but I understand she did a lot of crazy things on it. She's used to doing relationship drama and for comedic effect, and so that was the warm-up here. She's also the daughter of newscaster Brian Williams.
This cast is something to be applauded. Honestly, I didn't know a lot of these people were in it. I don't know Daniel Kaluuya. I don't know Allison Williams. I didn't watch Girls. I do know the parents, though. Bradley Whitford. I mean, I watched The West Wing a lot, and he was great on that show. I also first was introduced to him in Billy Madison, where he's actually really, really funny. We talked about him, I think, in RoboCop 3 and some other stuff.
Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah, Cabin in the Woods. I forgot about that, where he's in that control room. This this guy's a chameleon. I think of The West Wing, where he was really stand-up, but more often than not, he plays some kind of snidely, weaselly guy. So I'm not sure what I'm going to get. He looks totally different here. I haven't seen him in a while, I guess. He's aged, or they aged him up for this. I thought he was the psychologist with the beard and the hair and everything.
Well, we don't know them yet. We're told about them before we see them. We're told Chris is rightfully nervous that he's walking into a situation where he's meeting the in-laws, potentially, of a five-month relationship. And how are they going to respond? They live in the country.
But he's totally not racist because he would have voted for Obama a third time.
That's what she says to reassure him. He may be lame. He may say things that are racially insensitive, but it only comes from a liberal place. And I do think that's what makes this so interesting. It would be very easy to make a movie about race in which you go to extremes and find rednecks that are going to hunt them with shotguns. It's not what they're going to do.
Yeah, that was the surprise to me, that I thought, oh, okay, this is going to be racism as the evil Freddy Krueger. It's going to be, yeah, rednecks and Republicans. No, this is about liberal racism. This is about a much more subtle form of racism, and it just makes the film so much smarter. But we do see that obvious kind of racism pop up when Rose and Chris drive to the country home. We get this scene where a deer jumps out and hits the car. They pull over and they call the police.
I did not know what they hit. That was my biggest jump scare this whole movie, is they're having this little conversation in the car. Something brown is there. I thought they threw like a cat at the windshield or something. It didn't seem as big as a deer. But when the cop shows up and starts asking for his ID, all right, I know where this is going. I've seen this story in movies before. I've seen it on television. Every African-American friend I've ever discussed this with tells me the same story, that when a cop pulls them over, they comply 100%. Hands are always visible.
Yeah, even if they're not driving, they're asked for their ID. I mean, I've been with people where this has happened to them, where they've been passengers and no reason to check their ID.
The one thing I'll bring up, though, is the first time I saw this storyline portrayed, I remember it very clearly, was with Blair Underwood in L.A. Law in 1993. I'm curious what the movie's going to be able to offer me at this point that is more relevant than a 25-year-old TV episode. But
well, how could it compete with Blair Underwood?
I'm just saying this isn't a new statement.
Okay, it's not a new statement, but I do think the way that it's framed is interesting. What we were going to find out about Chris is he is haunted by a hit and run. His own mother was hit coming home from work. She died. He could have done something about it if he had been more of the man of the house, and he feels incredible guilt about being a child and behaving in a pain avoidance way. This really is about crossing that threshold, not only into the country and into a new kind of racism, but also into that subconscious where he's buried his mother.
Help me understand that exactly, because I know they bring this up. He was at home. His mother was hit. He didn't know. It's just that he didn't go looking for her when she should have been home, right?
Yeah, she didn't come home when she's supposed to be. Instead of calling the cops saying, my mom's missing, he just sat there and watched TV to ignore it. So there's this guilt of imagining her just lying on the street suffering when he could have been there getting help.
Yeah, I gotta say, let it go, dude.
This happened to him at very young. He hasn't seen a good psychiatrist like Catherine Keener.
I think that one or two good visits, it's not like he saw her out the window and couldn't cope and just became catatonic and let her die while he was aware of what was going on. He just wasn't proactive and wondered why mom was late.
Of course, we're applying rational thought to, you know, you're not rational. The things that haunt you tend to be things beyond your control. Again, the point is, what Peele really hammers home in the commentary is that he's a boy, and that if he had had a father at home, this would have been discovered. But because he was the man of the house and did not act accordingly, it makes him feel like he made a bad choice. But of course, he was a child. And yes, none of the audience is going to judge him for making that choice, but it's something that's going to play out again and again. And we're going to see this buck play out in different ways throughout the film.
But yeah, I think that all the deer is hearkening back to the death of his mother. It's not a harbinger of things to come.
Sure it is. And it'll be a weapon by the end of it.
It's going to get him out of bed where he's going to run into Missy. I mean, we'll get there. It's something that motivates and throughout this film.
It's a non-racial issue to talk about, as well as he's suffering from the fact that he's got to give up smoking, and he's got to give a good impression, and so he can't smoke in front of them, and that stresses him out. So of course he's going to call his friend. I think everyone wants to be a friend of Rod. He's awesome. scene stealer. Laurel Howery is, again, one of his first movies and killing it in every scene.
He is a stand-up comedian, I guess, out of the Chicago area, which is probably why he's so funny.
Yeah, I've not seen this guy before. He feels like he's in a different movie than everybody else because he's always on a cell phone talking to them. So I didn't get that he was really interplayed. I didn't know exactly what role he'd play other than perhaps confidant so that Chris could vocalize his misgivings and his thoughts to somebody.
Yeah, he serves in that way, but I also think he is the voice of blackness that Chris is going to reach out to as being surrounded by all these white people is freaking him out.
Right, that's also what I was thinking of, is somebody other than Rose. He could talk to Rose, but Rose isn't a black male. And so even though she's his very understanding girlfriend, it's not quite the same conversation as you can have with your friend anyway. So I didn't know if he'd actually play into the film. He will at the very end, but he is exceptionally fun. There's one scene where I think it goes a little bit too far. I feel it almost becomes Bernie Mac in Transformers, but by and large, I really enjoy all his scenes.
Yeah. And as far as the parents go, when we finally see them, Peel makes a really interesting choice with the camera. It's a wide shot. We cannot see exactly what their faces are like. We hear their voices. They claim to be happy. But if there's something going on with a flinch, we wouldn't know because we're pulling back on this lovely mansion and seeing that it's being observed by the groundskeeper.
Yeah, that is the first real ominous. I mean, sure, when you have that run-in with the cop, that's scary. I mean, that plays into real life. But the real ominous horror beat, I feel, is as you're pulling up to that house and you see Walter just kind of sitting there raking some leaves, looking at that car drive by. That feels scary. That's the first note that tells me, okay, something's not right here.
All right, let me jump to the end because I want to look at this retrospectively. I already spoiled. Walter there is the brain of Dean's father in that body, right?
Yep.
So why are they making him do all the Lauren work? And
well, they're keeping around. I think that he is enjoying the fact that he has a young body and can physically do things. He says, I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't enjoy it. I think it's a different story for the mother-in-law. I actually think that Catherine Keener's character hates her and is punishing her. And that a lot of their tension and why she yells at her is because she just doesn't like having her mother-in-law in the house. But this is the safest place to keep them now that they have gotten new bodies.
I mean, I think there are some things that they play just more for horror beats than actual logic in the film, like the grandparents here. It is weird that they're more a maid and a lawn care man.
But it's also a misdirect too, right? I mean, we think that we know what the story is. They're taking black people and making them slaves.
I wasn't quite sure. I didn't know who the good guys or bad guys were because we get Missy and Dean. Dean does most of the talking here in the beginning. Dean gives Chris a tour of the house. Everything he says seems to be so well-meaning, but yet it's cringeworthy so often when he's talking about his souvenirs from Bali and he's like, it's such a privilege to be able to experience another person's culture. Again, looking back on this movie, I get this is about brain transplant, but even without that, I'm thinking, you know, you're talking to a person of a different culture and saying this as if going to Bali allows you to completely understand what that is. Just like I drove through Compton once, so I know exactly what they're singing about in NWA.
Yeah. Again, it's the Obama era, right? We have a black president. We're post-racial now. This is not an issue in America, which is why I say this movie might be dated coming out in the Trump era, because obviously anyone now knows that this is a huge problem in America. But maybe a couple years before, you might be able to tell yourself, oh yeah, we're all cool with it now. And so, yeah, maybe he says these inappropriate things like, you got a thing going on. But for the most part, this is a character that is really trying to understand a adopt and like another culture. What we'll find out is that's actually part of the problem. They want to adopt another culture.
What's so telling with this tour, I mean, there's two things where they call out the parents where I didn't catch it the first time I saw it, but the second time it becomes very obvious. There's this story about the grandfather, Walter. He went up against Jesse Owens to get in the Olympics and Jesse Owens won. And again, the Dean is like, and thank goodness because we really showed Hitler up. Like, they got the white guy, but at least we showed up the fascist.
And again, I thought that was more cringeworthy. Yeah, liberalism. awesome.
And then there's also, they go to the kitchen on the tour. They go, oh, my mother loved this kitchen. We just keep a little piece of her. And you see Georgina. Like, again, I didn't catch that the first time I saw it. This time it really stood out because I knew where the movie was going.
It's about approval, right? I mean, someone from another culture is coming here and I want to make sure that they know that I'm not racist. So I'm going to talk about how much I love black culture. And yeah, thank God about Jesse Owens. And maybe they won't judge me. And instead, it comes off in a weird way like, well, it's an elephant in the room. And now you're only seeing me as a black man. You're not seeing me as a potential suitor for your daughter. They seem surprisingly okay with the choice here.
But it's not necessarily even a bad thing because everything at this point that Dean is saying, especially when he finally fulfills Rose's prophecy and says, by the way, I would have voted for Obama for a third term. Everything he's doing, though, feels well-meaning. Like he's trying to make Chris more comfortable by saying, see how okay with you I am. And it does play a little bit like comedy. Like he's going so far to be accepting that it's coming across really uncomfortable for Chris. And when you see, you know, later on that evening and he's like, I told you so. Nothing Dean does makes me suspect him of anything other than what he's saying. I mean, I just picture him listening to NPR a lot.
And NWA.
At one point, they're sitting outside and they're like, well, tell us about your parents. And I do feel like there's more of that guarded racism going on where Chris, you know, he has to say, oh, of course, my father wasn't around, which is a stereotype in the black community. They don't have fathers. They just run off. Like, he's almost ashamed to say that. These two actors playing Dean and Missy, just they look more concerned once they sit down and start talking about his personal life.
They probably already know things because their daughter has told them things, but we don't know that as a first-time audience viewer. And so Missy is becoming engaged. She's even holding her teacup and spoon that will become so threatening and pivotal later. But yeah, she really wants to know, you know, she says we don't have to talk about that. She doesn't need to talk about it now. She just needs to know what his weak points are so that when the time is right, she can get him. And she finds out that, yes, he's a smoker.
The one actor I don't care for in this, Catherine Keener.
What?
What?
Maybe I'm going to stand alone.
You will.
Yes.
I like this actress in general, but in this movie, I don't get a whole lot from her. I don't get a lot from her face acting. I find her deliveries to be flat. Here, I don't find her to be as kind as Dean, and later, I don't find her to be as evil. She gets some good scenes, and I like what they do with her character, but I feel like Catherine Keener's kind of phoning it in.
No, she's not chewing the scenery. She's not phoning it in. She's giving really good, subtle character work, and if you know any therapists, they're trained not to show their emotions. They're trained to deliver things flatly and not laugh at jokes. And again, she's just probing him. You can see it in micro movements of her face. There is a great performance going on there.
Yeah, I think she's the scariest character in this movie, even more than the brother Jeremy, like because she is so low key. And it's the subtle way, like when Georgina comes over and she spills that tea as she's pouring it into Chris's cup and go get some rest. Her delivery, the look on her face, she's not going to be saying, my man, and I would have voted for Obama a third time. I don't feel like she's playing that role. She is much more sinister.
Yeah, it differentiates the parents. You wouldn't want them to be two of the same thing. And I feel like every family member here, even though we'll find out they're all trying to achieve the same goal, they're doing it maybe for their own reasons and to varying degree. The character that can't contain himself is the younger brother.
Yeah, Caleb Landry Jones is somebody whose face I would never recognize. He has aged a lot from the role I know him best as, but his voice, every time I hear him asking that girl for a date by the fishes, Banshee from X-Men First Class. We talked about him when we did Now Peaking, but it didn't click for me. To me, this man will always be Banshee.
You know, he's kind of doing a Brad Pitt, right? When Brad Pitt has to do a kooky character, you know, be it 12 Monkeys or Inglourious Basterds, he kind of has this persona. I feel like he's really channeling it. Basically, this character really wants to have a black body. It's almost sexual, but it really just feels about like body worship. He believes that black men are more strong and powerful if they work out right. And he's done all of the martial arts. He's done the jiu-jitsu. He's got it in his mind. Now he needs the muscles. Now he needs the genes to really be the imposing figure he wants to be.
Yeah, he brings up his genetics and he just has the build for that. I think it was Jimmy the Greek. There were some sports announcer like in the 70s that got in big trouble for making assertions like that with black athletes.
And the way he does it, this is the character that comes off most racist. racist. The fact that he wants to fight, the fact that he's talking about genetic makeup and things. But when I heard him say genetic makeup, I'm immediately thinking race. But then I'm thinking also there is something just in genes, no matter what race you are, about whether or not you're athletic and whether you're coordinated and whether you're tall.
Yeah, but it's a stereotype with black athletes that blacks just have a certain makeup that make them better athletes.
I get that. I was trying to figure out where the conflict was going to come from. Was it going to come from Jeremy? And what he said, it felt more edgy and more confrontational than what Dean said, but yet it was all still couched in such a way that maybe I'm interpreting it wrong. And I'll tell you, I'm not white. I am a Latino, but I'm not African American either. But this movie does such a great job of making me sensitive to what Chris is feeling. And I'm going to again credit Daniel for that. His minor body language and everything. Whenever somebody says something like your genetic makeup, I am overly sensitive to that watching this. I think it's smart writing and I think it's great performance.
He knew it, right? I mean, we see that in the next scene when it's time for bed. It's Friday night and he's going to retreat. He's just going to be, you know, clicking away on his computer, and he wants to say it. I told you so. I knew that this would be the kinds of things we would be bumping up if you didn't tell them I was black. And she's madder than he is. She's the one, I think, again, it's an artful deception that she is so angry at her family for being so insensitive.
That is great, because she's exactly what you would expect a loving, committed girlfriend to be, is she's upset for him. Even when I figure out what's going on, I don't think she's in on it, and it's because of scenes like this one.
Yeah, the fact that she's like, I can't believe my mom, she's just as bad as that cop towards Georgina.
They kind of turn it around, you know, he was called a fucking beast at the table, they're going to turn it into foreplay for sex, and it's not like he can't deal with this. If this is as bad as they are, if they're just casually racist, he'll get through this weekend. He knows that his girlfriend loves him, and that's enough.
But a couple of things here bothered me. First of all, even if they were casually racist, I don't care what color you are. If you are being introduced to the parents for the first time, do you really screw in that bed? Do you share a bedroom if you're being introduced as the boyfriend? If you're living together, that's one thing, but I would think decorum would say you get two rooms and then you sneak into the other one's room. And the fact that we're going to see that even Rose is going to sleep naked or at least topless. I just found that to be an interesting thing. If they were casually racist, how could they be okay with that under their roof? I don't think if I were a father, I'd be okay with my daughter sleeping with a new boyfriend, no matter anything about him.
They see the racism because I know what their plot is, but if you're looking at them without knowing the end of this film, I think this is how a lot of people are racist, where they just don't realize they're being insensitive. You think by calling him my man and let me give you a fist bump, look, I'm down with your cold, I get who you are, when it could come off as pandering to them. Microaggression, if you want to use the new hip term.
Well, if that's all they're guilty of, I would say that this is a romantic comedy with some kooky parents. But of course, this is about co-option. And in fact, what's so evil about them? The twist that I couldn't see coming, that it's not we hate black people because we think they're subservient to us. We think they're a superior race, or at least some of them do, and we want to take their properties. And that's why when Chris goes out for a cigarette break late at night, he runs into the grandfather, quite literally, during his track meet exercises.
What was that?
Well, he's a runner. I didn't get it the first time I saw this film. Seeing it the second time, I'm like, okay, he was a runner, so he's doing his running at night.
Okay, I didn't get that. I thought he was running from something. Like that guy at the very beginning of the film, I thought he was being chased or something. And then the next day when Chris is going to ask him about it, he's so calm and smiley, I thought somebody got him or something. I wasn't sure. I just couldn't figure out why he was running so much at night. If you're training for running, why would you do it at night?
Well, because he can't do it during the day. He's got to pretend to be the groundskeeper. But it's just such a creepy scene. He's running straight at Chris and then turns at that like right angle. And you got Georgina, like Chris thinks she's looking at him at first, but no, she's looking at a reflection, kind of straightening her wig. I don't know if you know if it's a wig at this point, but playing with her hair at least.
Yeah, I assume that they're playing these roles of servile people because it's a good cover. And so any outsider would just assume, oh yeah, this is the help. But in fact, it may not be this way when it's not the annual party. It may actually be that it feels more like, yeah, this is my parents living under our roof and there's more bickering and more power play. Georgina will eventually say that no one is in control of her. It would be fun to get some kind of scene in which she and her daughter-in-law have a throwdown.
And where I thought this was going for sure is another kind of movie I don't enjoy, Stepford Wives. Only in this case, it's what? The Stepford Help at this point? I mean, the two African Americans here are so smiley and so compliant, but yet there's something weird when Georgina is pouring the tea. And I'm not even quite sure what happens. It sounds like something broke or she spilled. I'm not sure, but she's told to go get some rest. I just think we're getting into a Stepford Wives kind of scenario here. And I doubly think that when Chris goes back inside, and I will go with brain transplant, but I'm not going to go with the fact that Missy can subtly hypnotize you by stirring her tea. I actually studied hypnosis in college. I know a thing or two about it. I've actually hypnotized somebody. I was with Missy when she's like, you watch too much TV. We don't have to swing that spoon. And the next thing I know, she's a villain from Marvel Comics hypnotizing him.
We're just going to disagree here.
Yeah, I'm disappointed that you would not go with this conceit. I agree it's outlandish, but this movie is a satire. Yes, sci-fi concepts that aren't real happen here, but I think this is an incredibly creepy scene.
It's a great scene. I just wish there was something else to it. I wish maybe he'd consented for the smoking cessation.
There's a reason that she uses this teacup. Jordan Peele said this was how you would summon the house slaves. You would clink your spoon onto your teacup to let them know to come in, to take your plate out, or to bring the next meal in. I mean, there's a definite reason he's using this teacup and the silver spoon here.
And it's just so unique. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. It gives her a real signature. And again, it's subtle. At first, she seems nice. She's like, are you comfortable here? And then she's kind of riding him about, you're smoking and I don't like that, but it's completely understandable. And then it goes beyond the bounds when she's starting to probe about the mom. And before you know it, before Chris knows it, he's crying. He's falling into the sunken place. He's reliving his most primal terror.
I think Catherine Keener is great in this scene, but even more so, Daniel Kaluuya. Like, this is a gripping scene, and he's not doing much but sitting there with eyes wide open and tears streaming down his face, and it is an amazing scene.
That is where I just went, this guy is someone to watch. I could see this guy eventually accepting gold statues in his future. The red eyes, the tears, I don't know if they dripped something or if those were real, but his body language, his delivery, everything during this hypnosis, he's amazing in. This guy is great.
Yeah, it's how he got the role. This was his audition, and apparently he did it just like this for the director, and the director's like, on the spot. Yep, you got it. We could probably have other actors with higher name caliber. He's a Brit. He's not known here in America, I don't think, but they were like, no, I want to have this performance. And Chris is tricky because he is mostly reactionary. He doesn't do a lot in this movie. He's kind of a passive character. Even his backstory is about being passive, but you don't feel that watching this performance. It has everything to do with Daniel Kaluuya's performance.
And his arc is about becoming a more active character. And I know Jordan Peele got some criticism for not hiring an African-American for this role. They felt like that would have better tapped into things, but I got nothing bad to say about this actor. Amazing performance.
I relate to the character so much. I mean, he and I even have the same camera. So I love this character on screen, and I love what Daniel is doing with that. And when he goes into the sunken place, I know this movie, it wasn't a cheapo, but it wasn't big budget, but I love the way that looks too. You know, we reviewed Trainspotting earlier this year when Ewan McGregor got sucked into the floor. Here, we see it from that point of view, but then the way he floats in that blackness, I'm not quite sure how they did it, if it was green screen or whatever. It was a really cool effect. I think I may go back and check a bonus feature to figure that one out.
It's on a wire that they X'd out with digital effects.
And it almost seems like he's supposed to be in the ocean or something. There's stuff floating around in there. But what I really love is that his whole backstory is about watching TV while his mother died. And when he looks up, it does look like an old tube TV.
Yeah, again, I think passivity, I mean, you could say that about certainly my generation and maybe future generations, is that, yeah, we spend more time watching things than doing things. And so the idea that we're going to see passivity as watching TV, that that's haunted him since his mother died. Yeah, it's just a nice visual cue. It continues that theme and that backstory for that character, that he could wind up trapped in the moment he most dreads for eternity is quite a horror.
And then he's going to wake up the next day, and I'm surprised he's not a Stepford person because he was hypnotized. Part of me wonders, was it all a dream? Did he really go outside? Because he wakes up, he's dressed, His girlfriend's not there. I had noticed she didn't have her top on previously. I've tried to figure out, did this really happen or is this in his head?
I think that's confirmed by Walter. Walter says you were in her office a long time. Did it work? I love the way that this unfolds. The guy is chopping wood. Once the scene ends, Chris is turning around. He's about to put a cigarette in his mouth. The wood gets chopped, and at the same time, he realizes, I'm repulsed by the idea of smoking.
But then because it's Walter, and he's an African-American, I'm like, wait, did Walter spill the beans? Is Chris not supposed to know he was really hypnotized? Did Walter let him in on a secret? I'm still trying to piece together the conspiracy.
And I just love the way Walter acts. Nothing I don't want to be doing. Like, just the way he delivers his lines, and you know he doesn't want to be doing this. He says he wants to, but he doesn't.
Right. And so Chris starts going paranoid, and not all his ideas are right, but he's trying to tell Rose this, and Rose is like, oh, you mean I got a chance with him? He is looking really paranoid here.
But in hindsight, it's somebody she seduced anyway.
Yes, exactly. No, he has every reason to be. And certainly whenever he gets a call in from Rod, he will have that reinforced. But someone's messing with his phone, too. Every time he's trying to plug into his phone, Georgina will come in and unplug it.
That was like my biggest moment of horror. I actually put in my notes, oh my God, my phone didn't charge. No!
I mean, you got to come up with ways like that now for new horror films, because cell phones, they could go everywhere. Unlike having a payphone on the side of the road in 70s horror.
Yeah. And so everything about this day, it's Saturday, is about this party. It's an annual party that the grandfather started. It's been on the same date every year. Rose claims she didn't know that it coincided with her introducing Chris to the family. But of course, in hindsight, it is obviously an auction, a slave auction, in which all of these people of a secret society, which on the commentary, Peel calls the Red Alchemist Society.
What the hell does that even mean?
Well, they're all wearing red. Chris always has blue. I first noticed it with his shoelaces, and during this party he has a blue shirt. Everyone has like a red tie or some flare of red on.
Not everyone. I mean,
just about everyone, though. It's enough that it stands out.
Yeah, plus there's little signatures. What Peel has said is that he is working out their backstory as we speak. And so I suspect if there's a sequel to this movie, it will be about another of their plots. It won't be a follow-up to turning black people into Stepford slaves. It will be about somewhere else in the world, them doing bad. But the point is, they've been in existence ever since the Knights of Templar seeking the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail was to promise immortality, and they finally found it. By being able to put consciousness from one body into another, they're potentially going to be able to live forever.
Wow, that is a crazy amount of backstory that nothing is even hinted at. I guess we see that helmet, but I need a moment to process everything you've just said.
Or some sequels.
I suppose, and Blumhouse will pump them out cheaply, but the one thing I get is the immortality. I thought about that a little bit. Brains do break down. I guess this is good if you're one of those people who your mind is absolutely perfect and your body is starting to give out on you. I think this would be great if you have like a disease while young, but no matter what, brains get tired and old too. I don't know that they're going to be able to transfer two or three generations before that just shuts down.
What I think so great about this party scene is, again, on a second watching, it takes on a whole new meaning. When you watch it the first time, oh, here's a bunch more racist people. Oh, I know Tiger Woods. And again, that pandering. Oh, is it really better? You know, being black, and black is in fashion. But what's interesting, knowing these people's motives, like this guy is asking Chris about, hey, how's your golf swing? I used to be a really great golfer. And, you know, you have this Nielsen and Lisa. Nielsen has got the oxygen tank and he's frail and, ooh, feeling Chris's muscles, is it really better? Like, they all got their own motives, which become clear when you know what's actually going to happen.
It is something that escalates. It does start with, I love Tiger Woods, which could be a golfer's version of I would have voted for Obama again, but it gets weirder and weirder. But the one thing I noticed is throughout this entire party, everybody's smiling. Even Chris is trying to smile. He's giving almost like a Chris Rock-esque performance at times. Some of the head cocks and the WTF looks on his face. But the sound, it's like there's party music, But there is this bass, this unsettling rumble of bass throughout the entire montage of him being talked to by all these people. And it just is there to put you on edge that there's this rumbling going on while everything seems so happy on the surface.
Yeah, again, compliments to Peele just as a director. I will see whatever he makes next because this is a very confident debut. I hope it's in the horror genre, but I'll see anything because I just think he's a born filmmaker.
Yeah, he says he wants to keep up these kind of social commentary thrillers that he said his next film is going to be in that vein as well.
Cool. I think he's good at that. I mean, I definitely feel he studied the experts. I mean, again, Polanski, we haven't reviewed Rosemary's Baby or any of his films, but he is a master of the subtle build. And whether you like it ultimately or not, there's cool moves that are appropriated here. I also think that Rose has been dressed to look like Charlotte Gainsbourg in Antichrist. I don't know if you guys have seen that film, but it's also a movie set in the woods about primordial fears coming to realization, and you ultimately realize the woman is really evil and manipulating the man.
She reminded me of someone I'd seen. Yeah, I think that's it.
I'll say this. The buildup of this movie is a little bit too long for me. I love the performances, but by the time we are at this party and the 1 hour mark, I'm like, all right, there's only so much you can drag out smiling people before I'm going to wonder what else it is. If it did not have these engaging performances, and honestly, the funny dialogue, because it is just, it's so awkward, it's funny of people embarrassing themselves with racial comments to Chris, and that beat is hit home again and again and again, and I'm like, come on, let's get to some plot, let's get to some horror. Right when my patience was about to be up, everything starts being revealed, but it is a slow build.
See, I think it's a steady incline of tension, which, yeah, again, you get Rod every once in a while to laugh, but I feel like that tension just builds and builds up until the third act. I mean, when you meet Stephen Root's character, Jim Hudson, this blind art dealer.
Yeah, Stephen Root is an actor. I associate him mostly with comedy. I first became acquainted with him on News Radio with Steve Foley back on NBC. And then, of course,
my stapler.
I was going to Dodgeball, but yes, there is his role as Milton in Office Space as well.
Slightly more popular.
I've never seen this guy before, but okay.
What? He shows up all the time. I mean, he shows up in No Country for Old Men for a bit part. I mean, he's always popping up in movies.
Rephrase, I've probably seen him a million times. I don't remember him from anything in particular.
He was even in RoboCop 3 as the traitor.
That's right.
He does do dramatic, though. The first time I ever saw him really do drama, he was a bit character in True Blood, and I'm like, wow, he actually was pretty moving. And so seeing him here, I'm expecting comedy, but what I get is the first person who truly is blind to color and blind to everything and an art dealer.
And yeah, we have a lot of sympathy for him, not only because he's handicapped and not able to enjoy the art that he deals, but also because exactly so. He stands apart from everyone else. We see him apart from everyone else.
He calls everyone else out as ignorant. Like, he's saying what we're thinking as viewers. There's that scene where Chris, he's run into this other black fellow there, Logan, but he's dressed like an old white guy. Like, there's something weird about him. Chris decides to go upstairs, and I'd love that scene. Everyone's sitting there talking in the house, and as soon as he goes upstairs, they just shut up and like look up there and are listening to see what he's doing. It's scary. I just feel like that tension just keeps building in this film.
Yeah, and he calls Rod, and if I needed a release of tension with laughter, Rod, they're gonna make you your sex slave and everything. I mean, when you see Logan King, you do not think sex slave. I may think that he is going to sing Song of the South.
No, he is a sex slave. I think in this case, he's absolutely right.
I do love his monologue about Jeffrey Dahmer. Like, that is some stand-up routine that's just funny.
It was amazing. Knocking Oprah's friend Elanya Van Zant, that bitch can't fix my motherfucking life. Yeah, he's just great. He is in a different movie, but it informs this movie. It's a breath of fresh air. Every time the tension is getting too high, it's the valve release that allows us to laugh and go, whoo, boy, this is fun.
But right after that, you get this other tense-filled moment where Georgina comes in to apologize for unplugging that phone, and you get, again, something's wrong. She doesn't know what the word snitch means. We saw Logan. He didn't know how to do a fist bump, and I love this scene with Betty Gabriel, who plays Georgina. I guess I saw her in The Purge election year. I don't remember who she was in that.
Oh, her! She was good in that, too. But I love the camera angle in this, the way they get right up in her. It's almost like a fisheye lens. It makes her nose look huge. huge and her mouth look tiny. It's just such a great shot that makes everything feel off kilter.
Yeah, and she gets that single tear running down her face. Like, what is going on with these characters? Why do they tear up like that?
What is going on with these fucking characters? Because, all right, we're going to see with Logan King, a flash from a camera phone is going to make him become himself again. They're doing brain transplants, but yet a single strobe light can bring the other personality out. I think if you have a different brain, you're a different person, right?
That person is still in there. They're still deep down. They're in that sunken place. They're never totally taken out of the body, so they could rise back up at some point. They're sharing that brain.
Yeah, occasionally, and it seems to be triggered upon self-reflection and actually someone introducing the idea of race. You know, what happens is that, yeah, cameras, having to look at yourself, seeing yourself in this context might be one thing. I think it was the fact that Chris said, when I see too many white people, I get nervous, having to think about that concept. No, 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 no. I mean, I think that these are people that assimilate because they don't remember their place of origin. They don't want to.
I understand it's fantastical horror, but I just find the central brain transplant conceit, the hypnosis, all of that to be silly.
What Peel said was he was going for Frankenstein. So if it's silly, you can blame Mary Shelley.
I mean, I understand the metaphor they're going for when you have people standing there saying that fair skin has been in fashion and now the pendulum's swinging the other way, black's in fashion, and you realize everything that's going on. You got the other lady asking if the sex is better with a black person. I get it. We're talking about cultural appropriation here in the most unsubtle of ways.
And it should be said that Jordan Peele, as well as Key, they are biracial. And so that is part of their experience. So I think that's interesting that they are dealing with these characters where that black and white are struggling within themselves.
Yeah, I just wish that they'd come up with a bit more believable of a method here. I would have gone with the Knights Templar doing soul transformations. I was surprised when they were actually doing brain transfer. And it wasn't something like we're just going to transfer your consciousness a la Reanimator.
It's the nature of satire to take ideas and make them metaphor, and it's not real. You're right, it's satire. And so I don't bump up against that. I don't think, Arnie, you bump up against that in many slasher movies. Maybe why you're asking more out of this movie is because it's on a more intellectual level.
Go back to Silent Night, Deadly Night 3. I had the exact same problems with brains in a jar there. I have that problem with any movie that tries to be scientific poorly.
I mean, we know something's up with Missy when Logan, she comes out, oh, he had a seizure, and I just did some psych work on him and he's okay now. She was back there hypnotizing him again.
We already suspect Missy and probably Dean by association and certainly the younger brother. And now all of these people, now that they're kind of lurking and eyeing Chris to a great degree, there's some cutscenes where they do it even more. Chris is playing badminton and everyone has gathered to watch. But for the most part, all the cutscenes just sort of elongate the build that's been going on here. But finally, Arnie, I think you get it confirmed without a doubt what's going on. They're at the gazebo where Chris is unloading with his girlfriend at the lake. We may not understand exactly how this bidding is work, but we know that he's being put up to auction and that the artist that admires his eye for art is going to purchase him.
This is putting a whole new spin on the term silent auction, though, isn't it? I mean, I couldn't believe that they do it so damn quietly.
Well, again, to me, that's all about just the vibe and the airiness of it. They're told they're going to play bingo and then we see those bingo cards getting used for this silent auction, the way Dean is like doing those hand motions. It's just creepy. And then that's what I enjoy, is just the whole vibe of this film. Like, there's just that tension going throughout. Even when moments are relieved, like, you go right back to this auction scene.
It took me a while to figure out what was going on. I guess Chris gets sold for what, $10,000?
No, it's not money that's changing hand. This is all stuff I learned from the Blu-ray. If you have been a secret society collecting antiquities for centuries, you have all of this stuff. So these cards represent what they have, and what he's blocked out represents what he's willing to give up for Chris, but it's not money. And again, I don't think anyone would get that. That's something that's in Peele's head that he'll probably make explicit in a sequel.
Yeah, I'm fine thinking it was 10 grand, but seems a little cheap. I also wondered if it was 10 million because people kind of back out at the 10. But at this point, yes, slave auction, quite obviously. And now I realize something's going to happen to Chris. He's going to become subservient. I'm not guessing brain transplant. That is the furthest thing from my freaking mind.
I agree. If Stepford Wives is the blueprint, you would assume, again, the idea is to take away their soul and make them do their bidding. You wouldn't suspect, although it's there, it can be found throughout the film, you wouldn't suspect that this is a strange form of admiration, that they covet the black body, that they see themselves becoming better by incorporating the other culture.
And yet, not doing the culture. They're taking the physical attributes, but they don't know how to fist bump. They don't know what snitch means.
I don't think they want to be very different. I just want to have better sex, and I hear black men have bigger dicks, and I want to be able to be strong and run faster, and we know black men are stronger than that, and black women are more pretty, and she has a young body. Again, these are all based on stereotypes. It's not because they know the culture.
It's colonialism. We'll take all your natural resources, we'll take the stuff we like, but we're going to keep all the culture that we like as well. We're not going to adopt anything we don't like from you.
And again, in the era of Obama, that might be where you feel like racism is heading. I don't know that's what we would say about the last year here in America.
I'd say even 3 years. I mean, you tell me this was filmed in 2016. That feels a little bit late, because even by 2015, how many instances of police brutality and killing African-American men had taken place?
And again, that's nothing new either. It just started becoming the subject of conversation in mainstream media. But yeah, I think the script was written even earlier than that. If we like to pat ourselves on the back that we voted for a black president, we are cool with black people, then I think that this is a movie that's going to challenge those appropriations and those ideas. Chris, at this point, wants to get out. The movie's called Get Out, and he's ready to do that. He's not stupid. He's supposed to be there all weekend. There's a whole nother day tomorrow, but nope. I'm leaving. The question is, Rose, are you coming with me?
And I still think Rose is on his side.
Yeah, but I agree with him when he says, even if you're not coming with me, I'm going. And then he, like, wavers on that. I'm like, oh, just get out. The movie's called Get Out. Get out.
But it's all about that deer and his mom. Like, that's what keeps motivating him to make certain choices, is not leaving that person behind.
Yeah, she's all that I got, is what he says. The mom was all that he had as a kid. Now he's found a replacement, and it's really hard for him. You can see that struggle, and she makes it easy by saying, yes, I'll go with you, and let's pack a bag. And yeah, they're being creepy on the porch, playing with banjos and leering at him.
I thought it was a ukulele, but it sounds like something from Deliverance.
Yeah, that's what they're going for. But the point is that, yeah, they should be able to slip out of here. Bye, I got a sick dog. Except she just can't find these keys.
And here's the moment that I just didn't understand, is while this is happening, he sees a door is ajar, this little half door, and I'm thinking there's something bad in there, and I'm like, I don't care what half-size door is half open, I'd be getting the hell out of that house. But he's gonna go in there and look, and that's when you realize not only is Rose completely in on it, but here's pictures of her with all of her previous African-American boyfriends who we've seen around, and even an African-American girlfriend who's gonna be Georgina. It's like, oh shit, she's been collecting them.
No, Arnie, I disagree. I thought she was hypnotized and she didn't know what she was doing, because I'm still thinking she's on Chris's side here. I don't know why Chris isn't questioning it. I guess he just wants to get out as fast as possible, even though he's found these pictures. But this is one of the most tense scenes. Rose, the keys, like the way he just keeps asking for those keys, and then Jeremy's gonna show up and he's gonna have like this lacrosse stick, and Dean's gonna be blocking the door.
My mind was racing during the photo scene. I couldn't wait. Rose is good though. Rose isn't bad. How's Rose doing it? But when they go downstairs and she's fumbling for the keys, it's a slow 2 minute realization for me. But when she's still looking for the keys, I'm with Chris when he starts finally getting really mad. Obviously, he's the only person not in on it.
We want to give her every benefit of the doubt. I mean, because we like her so much, I want to believe that she could snap out of this and that they could go off into the sunset. And boy, when she pulls out those keys, all of those hopes, it's just crushing.
You know, I can't give you the keys, babe. Ugh.
Yes, I'm in the sunken place after that. But the director did point out there's a little clue there. She left that door open. That little door was opened by her. She wanted him to find that.
That's painful.
Well, yeah, this whole time they are messing with Chris. Like, Dean is going, born, we breathe and we'll die. We are the gods trapped in cocoons. Like, he's giving these weird talks as Rose is looking for the keys.
Yeah, and again, this all comes from the secret society that we'll learn more about later. But their mission is, they see themselves as gods, and to stay immortal is all that's important. And he is the guy. We will find out that Dean is the surgeon that perfected this coagula procedure.
Coagula, it's a confusing name because I think of, you know, coagulating agents and blood clotting and things.
Yeah, I think of coagulation in Dracula. I don't know what you get out of that.
But we do get into that basement with the black mold.
Yes. Creepy room. The deer metaphor comes back. Again, it represents his subconscious and all of that that he can't avoid about leaving his mother behind.
And here we get the exposition via video. I like the video, though, where it's like, hi, I'm Dean's dad, and I'm going to explain everything, and like, dino DNA.
This does feel like something out of The Shining. I mean, there's always that TV in The Shining that's almost in the middle of the room. It doesn't even seem to be plugged in. I got that vibe here. Like, there's no VCR hooked up to that thing.
Yeah, it's a little impractical. They probably should update the video. It's very 80s cheesy. But again, I think if this is a horror comedy, we are kind of laughing and screaming at the same time when we realize everything that's going to fall on Chris here. He'll later get a piped in interview with Jim Hudson where it's like, yep, I want your eye. I don't care about your race. For some people, it is because they believe that your race is superior. For me, I just know, or I've been told at least, you have a really good eye for photography. I've always wanted that. I was rejected by National Geographic. And so I'm just going to get that eye. Black, white, Chinese, whatever you are, I get your eye.
And that guy should have asked Jacob and I for second opinions on that photography because he's spending a lot of money for that.
We do get a comedy break here. We cut back to Rod, who has gone to the police. And I do feel like this is a little broad. Like, this feels like it is from a more comical film where he's talking about sex slaves to the police and then cutscene and they brought more police in to listen to this story.
This is the scene I said went a little Bernie Mac in Transformers. I'd be perfectly fine with him going and even being a little bit full of himself. Because he's TSA. I know what I think of TSA, and I know what I think of police, and it's apples and oranges different. I mean, when he says we handle stuff, yeah, you handle my water as you take it away from me because I'm not allowed to have a beverage when I fly. But I would completely go with it if he didn't come off like such a nut in front of them. And when she brings the other two detectives in, unfortunately, I'm five steps ahead of this joke. I know exactly what's going to happen when he's telling his whole tale and ends with sex slaves.
I think it's a great scene, though. And again, a necessary readjustment. It's great suspense to cut away from Chris, not get those answers right away, and be like, what is happening to him? The weekend's over, and what are they going to do to go to this comedy? Again, we're laughing, but we're feeling that tension. It was right before he was caught. He sent that picture of Logan, and Rod confirmed that it used to be Andre, somebody that dated a girl that he knew.
That person all the way from the beginning of this film, which I didn't realize it was the same person the first time I saw it.
Yeah, and again, he's burning. He's got the clue to bust this family, but what's he going to do about it? Is he going to stare at the dog the whole week? He's going to go to the cops. Eventually, he's going to call Rose, and I love this scene because both people are really smart. Rod thinks, you know, at first we're worried that he's going to buy her lie, and then he puts her on mute and is like, you're a lying bitch, and I'm going to tape you. But then when he comes back off mute, she's going to frame it like, oh, you're just trying to hit on me.
Yeah, and you know what I was really afraid of? That he'd go for it. I mean, Rose is very attractive, and I thought that maybe he'd actually go for it the other way and be the next person that they grab.
No, she's on her Microsoft computer finding her next victim. There's something creepy about Rose once she is revealed. Like, she pulls her hair back tight in that ponytail. Like, at the end, she's eating cereal and drinking milk, but they're not mixed. Like, she's eating Fruit Loops and then taking a sip of milk.
I found that to be a really odd little quirk.
Yeah, no, everyone in this family is a monster, but they're a different kind, and it's so impressive. Honestly, I think Dean is probably the least monstrous, and he's the guy cutting open heads.
Yeah.
But at least he's doing it for science.
Yeah, I guess so. But if you've been wanting gore, Arnie, is it enough for you to watch this surgery?
Nah, it wasn't. It was just like a squirt gun hitting a sheet. It was... I'm not a gore hound where I must have gore. I would rather just have believability and be invested in the characters. I am invested in these characters. But if that brain surgery was there to get grossness out of me, I think it was more gross just to see Steven Root blind in a hospital gown.
See, this works for me. I mean, Jeremy comes in to get Chris, and we've seen Chris, when he gets hypnotized, he starts scratching at the chair, and he's done something to block that hypnotism. There's cotton coming out of there. He's got to pick cotton to save himself.
Oh, I didn't get that. I just thought it was stuffing, but you're right. It probably was cotton filled. I guess I never thought what fills a chair.
Yeah, and he put that in his ears and was able to block out when Missy was trying to hypnotize him, so he's able to attack Jeremy. He gets him with, what is that, a bocce ball? I don't know how Jeremy survived that. There's a lot of blood coming out.
I thought for sure he was dead. And I start having this thought, and it continues throughout the climax. Well, Chris is screwed. He's in a white suburb, and he's killing white folk.
Yep.
I know how this movie's gonna end.
Yeah, and you know what? The party could have kept going. It's only Saturday night. Everyone went home, I guess, because they didn't get Chris. That was the whole point of the party. But certainly, you know, they could have been around playing bocce ball. They could have made this harder for Chris to get away if there was more white people around for the climax.
But it should be said, this is when he becomes an active character. Like, he takes that deer down off the wall and takes out Dean with the antlers. And sets the place on fire. I don't think he meant that, but Dean knocks over some candles. I guess there is some magic, Arnie. They had candles. That means there's some kind of magic stuff going on.
And it is the metaphor of taking the thing that haunted me, that feels like my dead mother, and I'm using that as a weapon to get out of this sunken place, such as it were. And all of these scenes are very effective. The second fight with Jeremy, where, you know, he's going to pull the sleeper hold on him, but he ends up with, I guess, a letter opener stuck in his hand, Missy, before she was taken out.
That was more gore than the brain. I was like, damn, did he just get stabbed through the hand?
Yeah, I love that he goes for the cup. He has to smash that teacup, and then Missy just attacks him, and yeah, that letter opener through the hand, it's hard to watch.
It's very satisfying to get all of this intense gore right at the end. A movie all about insinuation and then to explode in this way feels like just the right climax.
Yeah, I wish it had come 15 minutes earlier, but I agree. But yet, it's not the climax I felt this movie was going to go for. Something that was such a slow build and worked on eeriness and humor, I didn't expect it to end with Chris murdering the entire family.
It's kind of what we want. We'd like to see some justice, and again, we want to see him fight and get out, and he does. He gets to the car, and Georgina has to get in the way, and suddenly it's a psychodrama. Suddenly he's replaying his mother's death, and can he really drive away and leave a mother dying on the side of the road?
I love the oh shit moment I had, because I'm like, yeah, you need to go get her, put your camera flash in her face, she'll be herself again. But I never even thought, grandma?
Yeah, we see the wig fall off and the surgical scar, and she crashes the car, and then I guess she dies.
Yeah, she dies. Rose is going to come out with a shotgun, and I love how Walter comes running by and is like, go get him, Grandpa.
Yeah, and at the beginning of the movie, when he's talking about fearful of meeting the parents, he's like, I just don't want to be run off the porch by someone with a shotgun. It's kind of funny that she's the one with the shotgun.
Oh, yeah. And the fact that, yeah, the grandfather was the runner, and here he is coming after him, but this is the one where I really think I am upset with Chris, because he has the perfect weapon in his pocket. He doesn't need bocce balls. He doesn't need deer antlers. What he needs to do is sneak around a little more, find every African American in the neighborhood and just take their picture. And then he'd have an army on his side. I felt like a single camera flash was way too easy of a remedy for this.
You see what Walter does. I mean, he's going to shoot Rose in the gut, and then he's going to turn that gun on himself. Like, they cannot stand having this white person in their brain. So I don't know how well that army would do.
Yeah, I think it's temporary. I mean, we saw even earlier, Logan, he got a nosebleed, but after a little bit, they're able to take control again. Georgina might shed a tear, but ultimately she'll smile and say, yeah, I'm still in charge.
My favorite piece of acting from Allison Williams comes right at the end here, when Chris, he goes and he's going to choke her. And the way she just smiles, and I don't know, that the blood covering her teeth, it's just so menacing and so fuck you. Like, yeah, sure, you got the upper hand. You burned everything down. You've killed my family, but I'm going to sit here and smile right back at you. It's just menacing even till the end.
Does Chris go too far? Because this was the one act I couldn't go with the character on. I mean,
you realize what she was doing to him, right?
I understand, but Rose was already shot in the stomach. She was likely going to bleed out. And what I'm thinking is, Chris, you just burned down all the evidence of three murders, and now you're putting your fingerprints on her neck?
That's what I was worried about. The police are going to show up while he's choking her.
And indeed, they do, but it's worth pointing out, he stops. He stops himself. He does not strangle her to death. He lets go and she lives and she dies of natural causes a few minutes later. At least
natural causes. If bullets in your stomach is natural causes, let me know.
Well, okay. Yeah. Rephrase. She dies of her own injuries naturally rather than through strangulation here in this moment. We might have liked Chris to kill her because that gives him something to do. But again, we don't want to see him become a monster. And more to the point, what we see is dependent on, yeah, I guess, who's in the White House. The original ending for this was that the racist cop from the beginning would catch him in the act and he would go to jail a martyr.
Yeah, I saw that ending on the Blu-ray after I'd seen the full film. When I saw the ending that's attached to this film, I had the same reaction I had when I saw American Beauty. If you've ever seen the cut ending of American Beauty, it's basically the same thing. I'm watching American Beauty and I'm like, oh, that guy's going to jail. I'm watching this movie and I'm like, I know how this movie started. It started with Chris getting pulled over by a cop who wanted his ID even though he wasn't driving. I figure it's going to end with him unjustly getting sent to jail. It was self-defense up until he's choking Rose. That's where I felt he went too far. That's not self-defense anymore.
You've seen how well that has gone in real life. I mean, unless you could get the dream team on your side as your lawyers, he's going to jail.
Exactly what I'm saying is he's going to jail is how I thought this was going to go. That is, I guess, the ending they originally had.
And then Trump became president and Peele just felt like he didn't want to put out a movie that would be so bleak and hopeless that in the Obama era, ending on a cynical note felt right because we like to, again, think of ourselves as, well, we have a black president, we're moving forward, things are progressing. With Trump becoming in the White House, that wasn't the sentiment. And I definitely feel like giving a hero moment here, certainly for Rod, a character that deserves it. We absolutely love him. So why not have him ride in the TSA mobile? And what a great deadpan. I mean, they did about 20 different takes of what he could say to his friend, but they chose the best one.
I watched the cutscenes. I'm like, stop. Why can't you just do like what they did in the Requiem for a Dream cutscenes? Can't you just give us his different lines? Do you have to give us the entire setup? The walking to the car, the line he says. I'm so tired of hearing, we're TS motherfucking A. We get shit done.
You really needed a Brett Ratner a la Rush Hour to really make those bloopers fly, I guess. But politics aside, whether it's Obama or Trump in the White House, I do feel like you're a black director. This is your story. Tackling this subject. Traditional horror films, they're based on white cultural morality, Puritanism. That's why the virgin never dies. She ends up being the hero. So I do feel like, yeah, have the black man, who is typically the first one to die in these kind of films, be the hero and live and have the happy ending. I do feel like that is the right way to go for this movie.
I'll agree. I like Chris. I want to see Chris have a happy ending. I didn't want to see him go to jail, which is why I didn't want him to choke Rose. It's not that I had lingering affection for Rose. It's that I didn't want Chris to do something stupid and go to jail for it, just or not to choke her. I didn't want to see that happen. So that it's his friend that he drives off. I still think there's going to be some fingerprinting and everybody at the party knows what happened here. But I want a happy ending for Chris, even if it's not very believable. But will this movie get a happy ending? It sounds like it, but let's make it official. Jacob Stewart, do you recommend Get Out, Jacob?
What I really admire about this film is that it's not just tapping into something going on in our culture right now, or maybe a few years ago. I do agree with you, Stuart. Under Trump, it's turned into something different. But someone really tapped into that and spoke about racism and race in a really smart way while providing a really tense thriller with some good gore at the end, with some crazy twist. But what really stands out to me is not just what a great story it is, how well it's told, but for Jordan Peele is, yeah, again, he's done TV, but movies a totally different beast. Just how great this looks for, again, a first-time director. You can tell this is someone that has studied film. The performances he gets out of the actors are amazing, like across the board. Even if I'm not enthralled with someone's performance the entire film, everyone gets at least one scene where I'm like, wow, like that is a great scene that they just pulled off. That's what's so impressive here is that it's not just socially relevant, but it hits all those great movie-making checkboxes of acting, of directing, of cinematography. This is a very strong recommend for me.
Stuart,
Yeah, again, look, go back and look at the debuts of like a Craven or Romero, and maybe you like those films, but there's something more crude about them. What's so impressive is how stylish, sophisticated, without the crutches of using gore and, you know, cheap laughs. I'm so impressed that Peele was able to make this level of filmmaking something that is more akin to Lynch, Kubrick, Polanski as his first film. I'm just jealous, quite frankly. It's amazing. I'm even more impressed that there was an audience for this that was so huge, that people would have the patience to endure a horror movie where there was so little killing, so little blood, and it was just all about the performances, the bad omens, all the political racial subtext that's going on until that bloody climax. It is a movie that, in my opinion, exceeds the hype. I thought that I would like it, but I was blown away by how many layers and how many ideas are here, and I can't wait to see more of what Peele's going to do.
And I'm going to have a more muted recommend. It's still a solid recommend. I like this movie a lot. I think it's got a lot of things going on a technical level that are really great, so I agree with you. I'm very curious to see what Peele does next. This just does not feel like a directorial debut. The fact that he's had many seasons of television work and things obviously have helped here, but he's also got a gifted cast, an amazing score. It's not a type of horror that I generally like, and I really think that a lot of what it says about race is on the nose, and I'm not sure that it's saying anything really new, but it's saying it through horror, which is a new way of delivering that message. So it's a solid recommend. It's a good film, but because of some pacing issues, because of the ridiculousness of the underlying conceit, I'm not anxious for what he's going to do next if he wants to hit this note again. But I enjoyed Get Out.
Well, I do know one thing that Peele's working on. I can't wait. One of the best books I've read in many years is Lovecraft Country. And if you're thinking of H.P. Lovecraft, you're in the right direction. H.P. Lovecraft created a whole horror mythology with Cthulhu. He was also a known racist who believed in eugenics and had this really dark side.
What?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Yes.
I mean, I knew it was insensitive, but I didn't know that he specifically believed in genocide.
Yeah, he definitely believes in a white master race, but that's been challenged. In a recent novel by Matt Ruff, a writer I adore, he retold the Lovecraft stories through the African-American experience. The main character was a black man in the 1950s who was writing a travel book on how black people can protect themselves moving through America, and he stumbles across the Cthulhu mythos and deals with it from the African-American perspective. It's a tremendous book. And if they get half of it on the screen, it's going to be a great TV series. Peele is writing and I think directing the first episode. Can't wait. And I, again, suspect that we will see more of this Red Alchemist Society. Probably not more of Chris, but definitely more of Daniel Kaluuya and this cast.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. So thank you very much to our patrons. We hope that this review has entertained you and you're not dying to get out of the patron campaign.
If you do, you're going to miss our next show, Time for Release with Justice League, a movie that everyone loves, and I guess I'll go see Lego Batman.
Jacob, do you know we're doing this? This may be news to you.
I think I saw it on the schedule. I've seen the beginning of it like 3 times. My girls watch it a lot.
I have heard it called the best Batman movie ever.
I'm going to say no.
That might be an opinion I agree with. We are not doing a Lego movie retrospective.
Please stress that. No Ninjago.
Ninjago. Come on, Stuart.
Whatever. All right, I'll just go ahead and say it because I've said it before. I saw the Lego movie because everyone told me it was hysterical and I hated it.
Yeah, it's all right.
Listen, Ninjago, nothing else needs to be said in order for me to say we will never ever. I don't care if Spider-Man, Batman, and Luke Skywalker team up. We're not doing that. And we're not even doing the first Lego movie. But the Lego Batman movie stands alone. We've had a lot of requests. And this patron campaign, we're going to use this as an experiment to see if you guys will go with us and let us do a one-off review of a movie that is part of a series. But really, it's Batman-y enough. We think that maybe we can fit that one in.
If it's better than Mask of Phantasm, then I'll be happy.
Don't remind people that we don't like that. Arnie's going to get angry emails now.
Oh, they're going to get angry emails. I'm reviewing the movie, so, you know, it's going to happen. But I'll try to approach it with an open mind. If you say it's good, I want it to be good. We'll see next month.
So thank you for your patronage. Thank you for listening to Now Playing in general, and especially supporting us. And Jacob Stewart, thank you for joining me for this review. I've enjoyed it a lot. But now, get out! Get out! Get out! Get the fuck out of here!
Bro, how you not scared of this, man? Look, they could have made you do all types of stupid shit. They'd have you fucking barking like a dog, looking ridiculous, okay? Or, I don't know if you know this, white people love making people sex slaves and shit.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign. And we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
You know what? I am grateful for what you've done today.
Now Playing relies on support from listeners like you to keep going. So thanks to you all.
And don't ever, ever say that I don't do nothing for you.
Now that you've heard this review, head to the Now Playing podcast forums and share your thoughts on this movie. The link to our forums is at nowplayingpodcast.com.
All right, babe. All right, I'll talk to you soon. See you.
The film Get Out and all audio clips and music used are the property of their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. This podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created or produced that film. Now Playing is an independent movie review podcast with no affiliation with any company involved in the publishing, creating, or distribution of that movie.
You realize you're coming off as like the world's biggest douchebag right now, right?
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Well, I should get back to work and mind my own business.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2017, all rights reserved, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Now, sink into the floor.
Wait.
Sink.
It turns out the Armitages, that's a hard fucking plural.
You could say Armitage.
Armitage.
It turns out the Armitage family.
She's also the daughter of newscaster Brian Williams.
And he was there when all this happened.
Interesting. Well, he was fired. What else did he have to do?
I'm making the joke of why he was fired.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, it's just like he was on the chopper.
Yes.
Basically, this character really wants to have a black body because he believes that will make him a better MMF, is that right?
MMA.
Yeah.
WWF, I think is what you're crossing there.
No, MMF is actually a certain kind of three-way.
Oh, stop.
I don't think that's what he was going for.
Yeah.